This is lecture number 4 by Alan McCrae on the book of Jeremiah. Lecture number 4. We have been having assignments lately that feature events in Jeremiah's life in the time of Zedekiah, and we have seen a little of what he had to go through at that time as he stood for God in a nation that had a tremendous revival under Josiah, maybe 20 years or so before, but the nation had largely lost the results of that revival and had turned away from God. This era is very similar to the one in our own time, which might be called by the phrase, quote, a post-Christian era, end quote. And so the book of Jeremiah has very great relevance to us today. Now, here's a book which is not a commentary on Jeremiah, and it is not a discussion of the problems we are taking up in this class, but it is an application of Jeremiah to our present time. The book is called Death in the City by Dr. Francis Schaeffer. And right at this point, there are a couple of pages of this book that are so appropriate that I would like to read them to you. On page 65, we read, and now I'm going to be quoting for an extensive amount of time. We have already had a glimpse of the personal results through Jeremiah that the preaching of judgment brings. In Anatoth, the people said, "Keep quiet, or we're going to kill you." We haven't looked at that particular chapter yet. That was in an earlier part of the ministry. But the threats to his liberty were not idle, for we read in Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 2, "Then Pashur smote Jeremiah and put him in the stocks that were in the high gate of Benjamin, which was by the house of the Lord." The first thing that they did was to fasten him in the stocks. Poor Jeremiah, who had been preaching faithfully in the post-Christian culture of his day, finds himself in the stocks. But his punishment didn't end there. The stocks were not enough for him, so they put him in prison. For then the king of Babylon's army besieged Jerusalem, and Jeremiah was shut up in the court of the prison, which was in the king's house. Just as this prophecy is coming true, just as the king of Babylon is at the doors, just as the false prophets are being proven wrong, Jeremiah is put into prison, the prison that is in the king's house. Those who know of Doge's Place in Venice can picture this, because that palace contained the most important prison. Apparently, it was the same here. Later, in Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 1, Jeremiah is still in prison. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah a second time while he was yet shut up in the court of the prison. And even that was not the end. In Jeremiah chapter 37, verses 15 to 16, we read, "Wherefore the princes were wroth with Jeremiah and smote him, and put him in prison in the house of Jonathan the scribe, for they had made that the prison. When Jeremiah was entered into the dungeon and into the cells, and Jeremiah had remained there many days." And so they gradually increased the punishment from the stocks to the prison to the dungeon. Finally, as we read in Jeremiah chapter 38, verse 4, and in verse 6, "Everyone must be moved. For here is a man of flesh and blood like ourselves in a historic space-time situation with his own aspirations, and he's carted off and put into a dungeon. And now his life is very much threatened. Therefore the princes said to the king, 'We beseech you, let this man be put to death, for he is weakening the hands of the men of war and remain in the city.'" That is, Jeremiah is not giving a very optimistic answer to what's going to happen. He's not saying that everyone's going to turn out well, nor is he saying that everything is going to turn out well. He isn't saying there's an easy solution. All we need is a little more technical advance to make the grade. No, he's cutting down their humanistic optimism, saying that they're under the judgment of God, and thereby, by this message, they say he is weakening the people. He is weakening the people and undercutting their morale. They said, "For this man seeks not the welfare of this people, but the hurt of the people." Of course, that's not true. Jeremiah is wanting their real welfare. He is saying you must be healed of your real disease, which is your revolt against God and not merely of some superficial external wound. But that didn't please the dignitaries, so we read, "Then Zedekiah the king said, 'Behold, he is in your hand, for the king is not that he should be able to do anything against you.' Then they took Jeremiah and cast him into the dungeon that was in the court of the prison, and they let down Jeremiah with cords, and in the dungeon there was no water but mire, so Jeremiah sunk in the mire." That is to say, there was probably a cistern in the prison, and he is being let down into the cistern, which had a lot of sediment on the bottom, that was miry, and Jeremiah is sinking into the mire. Well, we continue the story, and we continue the quote from Dr. Schaeffer. "The story would make a vivid drama, but it is not merely a piece of theater. Jeremiah, a man like yourself, was put into the innermost dungeon, where they put a rope around his arms and lowered him down into the mire. As he went down, he must have wondered, what in the world are my feet going to touch? He wasn't going to drown, but there was mud at the bottom, and as they let him down, he sank into the mud. And he sank, and he sank, and he sank, to his knees, to his waist, to his armpits. We do not know when he was there, but he was there as a result of his faithful preaching to God's judgment to a post-Christian world. It's no small thing to stick with a message. It's easy to walk out. Both hippies and evangelicals easily can opt out of their own little ghetto, saying nice things to themselves and closing their eyes to the real situation that's around them outside of the ghetto. One can opt out in many ways, but if one really preaches the word of God to a post-Christian world, one must understand that he is likely to end up like Jeremiah. I continue quoting from Dr. Schaefer. We must not think that Jeremiah's trials were merely physical. They were psychological as well. For Jeremiah never saw any change in his own lifetime. He knew that 70 years later the people would return, but he wouldn't live to see it. Jeremiah, like every man, lived existentially on the knife edge of time, moment by moment, and like all of us, he lived day by day within the confines of his own lifetime. Jeremiah was not just a piece of cardboard. He had a psychological life, just as you and I have. How then was he affected? There were times when Jeremiah stood in discouragement, overwhelmed by preaching the message of God faithfully to his culture and ending up in the stock, in the prison, in the dungeon. You say, how can a man of God be discouraged? Anybody who asks that question has never been in the midst of a real battle. He understands nothing about the real struggle for God. We're real men. We're this side of the fall. We're not perfect. We have our dreams, our psychological needs, and we want to be fulfilled. There are times of heroism when we stand firm and are faithful in preaching to men who will not listen, but there are also those times when we feel totally overwhelmed. And here I end the quote of Death in the City by Dr. Francis Schaefer. And Dr. McCrae continues, I think there's a very fine treatment in this book by Dr. Schaefer's Death in the City of the application of much of this material in Jeremiah, its application, that is, to our own time. Now, we have been looking particularly at events in the latter part of Jeremiah's life. We have much more autobiography there than we have in the earlier parts. But there is a considerable amount in the early parts as well, and I think we understand the early parts much better by having a realization of where Jeremiah is and what he has had to go through before he was finished. And so we have taken this material to get a good glimpse of the time of Zedekiah to this point. But now I want to go back and start near the beginning of the book. And in general, the rest of the time, we will go through the book in order. I'm not going to give you a detailed outline of the book. It is not an easy book to outline. And you can easily see why this could be. The experiences that he went through were written down in the midst of these experiences, and most of them consist of what he actually said in standing before the people. And now you remember, they were written down later as he remembered them, and then the king cut his earlier work up, and then he redictated it with other material added in between, and then at a time of later events, which seemed to him to fit in certain places of his rededicated work, he inserted these things in those places. And so the book is not strictly chronological, but in general, there is a chronological arrangement to the book. In general, it starts with the beginning of his life, of course, and it goes on in the book to the end of his ministry. Towards the end, there are a few chapters that perhaps don't belong at the very end if you want to be strictly chronological, but which, from a viewpoint of subject matter, are placed at the end of the book. In fact, those chapters which are placed at the end of the chapters, in which he deals with foreign nations and tells God's judgment against those nations in the Septuagint, are inserted in the middle of chapter 25. Back there, where it tells how Jeremiah gave messages of God's punishment to other nations. There, the Septuagint has the last few chapters of Jeremiah, except the very last chapter. I don't know if the translator of the Septuagint was trying to make the whole thing more chronological than it is by inserting these chapters at that point. I think that the arrangement that we have in the Hebrew is probably better because the subject matter is quite different, and therefore, even though they were given probably long before the end of his ministry, it's better to have them at the end of the book. But aside from these chapters, the book is, in general, quite chronological. The events of Jeremiah's life would fall under four headings. First would be the events under Josiah. In the early chapters, it's doubtless material that he gave at the time of Josiah. That would be from the 13th to the 18th year of Josiah. In other words, the first 5 years of Jeremiah's ministry were before the great revival that Josiah conducted. And then from the 18th to the 31st year would be after the great revival, so there is no division in the book of Jeremiah to show us whether particular chapters come before or after that event, that is, the revival. But there are the early chapters of the book, perhaps at least a third of the book, consisting of what is said to be happening during that period, interspersed with occasional complaints by him, and an occasional reference to an event and an occasional prayer by him. And so, as this sits in the Hebrew, it just goes right straight along, and since most of you are reading the King James Version, too, we have to supply our own headings and make our own divisions. It makes it way more convenient to use the chapter divisions that were put in by the archbishop in the 13th century. In another way, they are apt to be misleading because quite frequently the archbishop wasn't very good as to where division should be made. But that is the first part of the ministry under Josiah, and it covers at least a third of the book of Jeremiah, being during the time of the revival. The second part of the book cannot be sharply divided from the first. There are chapters we know belong in the second part because of the dates, but we don't know how much of the first part may have been in the second period or may have been repeated then. The second period, of course, would be under Jehoiakim. We don't need to make a special division for the 3 months of the reign of Jehoahaz, who was carried off by Pharaoh Necho to Egypt, because we have no evidence whether any particular part of the book of Jeremiah was written during those 3 months or not. And so the second part, or period, is under Jehoiakim, a period in which Jeremiah was protected. There were many leaders among the people who had a strong desire to protect him, and they did. We read some time ago about how the king wanted to kill him and the leaders prevented him. But the king was able to send clear to Egypt to get another prophet who had given a message that was very similar to Jeremiah's, and he seized that prophet in Egypt and brought him back and killed him in Jerusalem. And so we see that the king's hatred was very great, his power was great, but these officials must have had a very great interest in Jeremiah and had a very great power in the kingdom such that they were able to protect Jeremiah during that time when Jehoiakim wanted to kill him. We have a number of chapters which are specifically connected to Jeremiah's relationship with Jehoiakim. Some of the first part of the book may have been given at that time or may have been repeated at that time. Of course, where it's not stated, we don't know. Then the third part, of course, is under Zedekiah. This was a time when Jeremiah was greatly honored by some. Remember how Ebed-Melech was able to preserve Jeremiah's life, even though Ebed-Melech was probably not a man of great influence, but he was placed in a strategic position there where he was able to bring Jeremiah's complaint to the king, and he was able, under the king's orders, to take 30 men and go and rescue Jeremiah out of the dungeon in the deep mire in which he had been. But the leaders of the people at this time seemed to have been quite hostile to Jeremiah and wanted to kill him. But the king, though he was a weak king, afraid of the corrupt leaders that were left over from Jehoiakim's time, he was able to protect him during that period. Now there is a fourth period, a brief one after the fall of Jerusalem, and we have a few rather interesting and important events that took place in Jeremiah's life and prophecies that he gave specifically at that time. We haven't looked at them yet, but we will leave them until we come to them in going through the book. Now, as I said, we cannot divide this book strictly into these four divisions. We cannot do it because it is not arranged strictly chronologically. We cannot be sure in some cases at which time a prophecy was given, but in general, it's rather clear. And of course, the last section was after the fall of Jerusalem and is quite definitely in the book. Jeremiah might have repeated some of his earlier messages, but we have no reason to think that he gave new messages other than those that are specifically designated as such for that period. Now I want to start going through the book. I think what you've looked at so far gives you a background that makes it much easier to understand than if we had simply started at the first chapter without having looked at these later chapters to some extent. I'm not going to divide this part into main headings because it is rather difficult to do that, but simply as sections. And so the first section would be, of course, the first chapter that we have already looked at. Section 1 of the book would be chapter 1, which is Jeremiah's call. And the statements in that chapter, which we looked at, are about how God was going to bring punishment. You've already seen the fulfillment of that in what we've looked at thus far. There is a statement relating in this chapter That is chapter 1, verse 18, and I quote, "Today I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar, and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but you will not be overcome. For I am with you and can rescue you, declares the Lord." End quote. Jeremiah, in the 13th year of Josiah, had no realization of just what these verses meant. But certainly, as time went on and he had this tremendous opposition, he saw others being killed for doing exactly what he was doing, and saw the tremendous effort, opposition, and antagonism, the denial of God in the land, he must have realized how wonderful it was that God had given him this promise. But occasionally, he gives way to great complaints, and we have expression of this terrible sorrow of his times when he is threatened, almost driven to give up the work that he's entered into. And I think, for you as a person who is truly going to serve the Lord these days, that the book of Jeremiah is a tremendous help to you in your own personal life. You can see how God led Jeremiah, how he directed him, and what he accomplished through him, and know that if you're entirely true to him, he may accomplish a great deal through you too, but you have to be ready to go against all obstacles, difficulties, and discouragement, just as he did. The book does not give any one of us assurance that we have a long life and will be able to effectively serve the Lord. It does not promise us that because we have seen the account of other prophets who gave the same message in Jeremiah, but who was killed. Thus we see that it may be God's will to use us through a long life of loyalty to him, or it may be his will that we should witness to him by suffering and death. But the book should be a great encouragement to us not to abandon the task or turn aside, as many do when the going gets hard. God has some of his servants where things work out smoothly and a great deal of things seem to be accomplished. Others face tremendous obstacles and don't seem to accomplish much. But if they're really true to the Lord, no one can say how great the amount may be that they are really accomplishing for the Lord. Only God knows the results. He wants us to be faithful, and he knows truly which results are tremendously important and which aren't. So this first chapter, I think, is a good chapter to read over when you become discouraged at times. But then, for the second section, I've already given you a very general title, and it's, quote, "Judah's Sin Against God," end quote. The second section is emphasizing particularly the people among whom Jeremiah was living. So I'm using the word Judah at the start because, as you know, Jeremiah was in the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom had been taken into exile in Assyria about 100 years before this time, about 722 BC. And so you can naturally expect that most of Jeremiah's efforts will be spent in dealing with the people of the southern kingdom, or Judah, the kingdom which is now called the Kingdom of Israel, because the northern one was gone. Two-thirds of the people were already in exile, therefore, it could take the title of Israel, and yet, when there was a northern kingdom that was larger, this northern kingdom took the name Israel. Sometimes the southern kingdom was called by the name of the largest tribe, the kingdom of Judah, and both terms, Israel and Judah, are now used for the southern kingdom. So when you find the term Israel, you must always ask yourself, at this time, three questions. Does the term Israel relate to the kingdom of Judah, which is in the surviving Israel kingdom? Or is it a term for the whole nation here? Or is he speaking just historically back to the northern kingdom? This illustrates the ambiguity of the human language at that time and the way the term was used in those three ways. Actually, there are comparatively few terms in any language that have more than one possibility of interpretation. I was thinking the other day about inerrancy. Is a word in the scripture inerrant? I think the answer is a single word cannot be inerrant. How can a word be inerrant because a word doesn't give you any meaning? I say, Hatfield. What does that say? It says nothing at all. You don't know what Hatfield is. Whether I am speaking of the palace in which Queen Elizabeth first lived before she became queen, or whether I'm speaking of a city in Nebraska, or whether I'm speaking of a town in Pennsylvania. I've heard people say Hatfield simply referring to the seminary here. The word Hatfield can be used in many ways. A single word cannot be considered inerrant because it conveys no meaning. So you have to have more meaning. You have to have a sentence, and in most cases, a sentence needs context so you understand what the word really says. Almost any sentence can give you a little meaning, but almost any sentence raises more questions than it answers, and you need context to know what a word really says. So in this case, I'm specifically going to call this section Judah's Sin Against God, and it would seem to be rather likely, coming right after the account of his call, that this was one of the first messages. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 1 says, quote, "The word of the Lord came to me, go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem," end quote. And then he starts in very naturally, quote, "I remember the devotion of your youth. How as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert, through a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. All who devoured here were held guilty, and disaster overtook them, declares the Lord," end quote. What a recollection that is. What a summary of the way God delivered them from Egypt and brought the plagues upon the Egyptians, the way he protected them in the journey through the wilderness, and the way that he enabled them to conquer all the land of Canaan. God's tremendous blessing to them in the past is here summarized, thinking particularly about the early days of the Israelites. And then he says in chapter 2, verse 5, quote, "What fault did your fathers find in me that they strayed so far away from me? They followed worthless idols and became worthless themselves," end quote. And then he continues up through verse 8, speaking of the marvelous blessings that God had given the people and the way that the people had turned against God. Then in chapter 2, verse 9, he makes his arraignment, quote, "Therefore I bring charges against you, declares the Lord, and I will bring charges against your children's children. Cross over to the coast of Kittim, and look, send to Kedar," end quote. Now, Kittim, or Kittim, is a name that refers to all the areas to the west. As some try to prove that Kittim refers specifically to Crete, but that is highly questioned. There was a small settlement in Crete that had a name somewhat similar to the word Kittim or Kittim, but whether the name Kittim comes from that town or whether the name was already there before the town arose, we don't know. I was sent a copy of a section from a new translation that someone is preparing. They asked me to look it over. It wasn't in Jeremiah, by the way, it was in a different section, but I looked it over and they had in it translated Kittim as Crete. And I wrote strongly urging them to change that because the name is clearly used for almost any region west of Palestine. From Palestine, you look out at the Mediterranean Sea, and the name is sometimes translated coastland or isles in the King James and other translations. It is that whole area there that is viewed as Kittim, that is the whole area to the west looking across the Mediterranean from Israel. And so in this case, it simply means, quote, "Look way off to the west," end quote. "Look at the coasts for Kittim and send to Kedar and observe closely." And Kedar is the name of a section of Arabia, so that refers to the east. What Jeremiah is really saying is, look in all directions. Quote, "Look to the west and look to the east and observe closely. See if there's ever been anything like this. Has a nation ever changed its gods?" Yet they were not gods at all. "But my people have exchanged their glory for worthless idols," end quote. Now, are we going to take this as meaning that up to that time no nation has ever changed its gods? I think that would be jumping pretty far for a conclusion from what it really says. It's a rhetorical statement. Maybe none ever had up to that time, but certainly there have been instances where nations have changed their gods. In America today, for example, as a whole, certainly most of our universities, certainly in the great mass of educated people today, the allegiance is not being paid to the God of the Bible, but to the humanistic idea that deifies God. And there are many blatant expressions that there is no power except man, and man is only the result of a series of evolutionary accidents. I was much impressed a good many years ago when I visited Constantinople to hear a story of something that I was told had happened to a tourist who came through at that time. And they said that there was in the cool of the morning when it was quite chilly that they saw Muslims there washing their feet in order to be able to go into the mosque because there they have to take off their shoes in order to go into the mosque. This American who observed it was quite overwhelmed and said, quote, "Imagine those people. It makes me shiver to see them there in the cold washing their feet in order to go into the mosque." There must be something to this business of religion after all if it will have that effect on people, end quote. Well, it really is a shock to see that attitude of many in America today that they simply turn away like the people in Israel had from the one who had established them and the one who has established us and given us all that we have. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Well, it implies that the Jews were exchanging gods. But you would find the loyalty of many who believe in lies, who believe in false gods, is so great that it puts to shame many of us who claim to believe in the true God and who have experienced salvation through Jesus Christ. Jeremiah says, quote, "Has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they were not gods at all, but my people have exchanged their glory for worthless idols," end quote. And of course, in America, a great part of our educated class has exchanged that which made America great for that which is purely imaginative. For that which does not profit is, of course, the idols in that case. Of course, in our case, it is not physical idols. It's all a problem of translation. If you're going to use the New American Standard, by the way, let me say this. If you know Hebrew and Greek, but don't want to take the time to look everything up in these languages, you can find the New American Standard Bible probably the most useful than any translation because it follows the original very, very closely. It follows it so closely that one who doesn't know Hebrew or Greek often fails to get the meaning at all from it because it follows the original idioms. And there are places like this where what it refers to is clearly understood, but the average reader might not catch it. And so, after you know Hebrew and Greek, this translation, the New American Standard, is a most useful tool. Now, the New International Version, or the NIV, has tried to give the meaning in a way that can be understood easily by people today who don't know Hebrew and Greek, and they try to preserve as much of the beauty of the original language as they can. It cannot conserve as much as the King James does because the King James was written in a language that was, I believe, far more beautiful than the English language today, the language of 300 years ago. But of course, none of us understand very well the language of 300 years ago. I've been amazed how many people have read the King James Version all their lives and still don't know the difference between you and ye, or thee and thou. I have found very few who know the difference between you and ye, and yet they are used consistently throughout the Bible with a definite difference of usage between them. But people read and read and read the Old Testament. They read you and they read ye and have no idea what the difference is. It simply shows how we need a Bible in our own language. Now, if you're going to put the Bible in our own language, you have to insert words occasionally to make the meaning clear to the reader of our day. And the King James does that a great deal. But when they do, they put these words in italics. And today, very few people recognize what italics means in the King James Version, and they're apt to emphasize the words that are inserted instead of merely realizing that they are words that were not in the Hebrew or Greek originally, and that they were inserted into the English in order to make the meaning clear. I don't know of any modern version that uses italics the way the King James does. And so, in most of them, you find words inserted that perhaps sometimes go a little too far. The New International Version has tried very hard to be accurate, but it also has tried very hard to get excellent English and clear English, and I've been on committees working on it when we've come to a verse, and one person says something like, "Well, here's what it means," and another person says, "Yes, but that doesn't convey the meaning to the people today." That's jumpy. That's awkward. That doesn't convey today's meaning. Do it this way. Then another says something like, "Yes, that's a beautiful presentation of the meaning of that verse, but it's not what the original says." And then we have worked for a whole hour trying this and trying that and trying the other thing, and eventually at the end of the hour, we have made a translation of the verse which we all agree was very, very close to the original and was in good, clear, modern English. But you can't spend an hour on every verse like that, or you probably would have to spend 10 or 15 years making a translation. And so there are many cases where the NIV, or New International Version, translations are most remarkably excellent, and there are other cases where the difference between two possibilities has been decided by five or four people in one committee. And I was on the four side of a number in some of those cases, and I am sure that there is no one who participated in the NIV translation who would agree with everything that is in the translation of it as we have it. But I think everyone who was on it would agree that the translation is much better than any one of us could have done by ourselves. I think it is a very good translation, but I find occasionally a point here and there where it changes the meaning from the King James, where I think, frankly, the meaning in the King James really represents the original better. So the best thing is to follow the Hebrew and the Greek for yourself. But I have found myself that many times using the NIV for sections I didn't work on, the meaning just comes right out, where I have read it over and over in the King James before, and I never stopped to think about the fact that I really didn't understand exactly what the verse meant. I just kept seeing words without realizing that I had not gotten more than a superficial idea of what the words actually meant. And so what I'm saying is, if you read a modern translation or read a translation that's different from what you habitually read, you will find aspects of Scripture that will jump out at you, and you will have a better understanding than what you may have if you continue just reading the same translation over and over again. So let's go back to Jeremiah. Let's go back in this case where we have, quote, "You've exchanged their glory for worthless idols," end quote. In the whole context, he's teaching about God. If you want to say, quote, "for worthless gods that are no gods," end quote, you might want to say for, quote, "worthless forces," end quote, or something like that that would fit today better. If you take a book like Cosmos, the one written by Carl Sagan, he has most tremendously interesting material about the stars and the planets and some material about ancient history where he's not always completely accurate. But he's got some interesting points, some material in biology and paleontology, which, of course, he's gotten from others and can't really speak as an authority. But as you read the book, you get the feeling of the tremendous thing that man has accomplished and how we're able now to send out rockets so far and to send out satellites so far and what tremendous things we've accomplished and what we've learned from these rockets and satellites. But if you read it closely and carefully, you will find every now and then that there is that which shows, after all, how futile everything is. When you get into it, you will find Carl Sagan describing a universe that is utterly limitless, so limitless that nobody could possibly comprehend it. And you'll just get the feeling, well, what is man? Just like a little ant that could be run over by a car going by, and that's the end of it. And then, as to what it all amounts to, in one place he says perhaps every tiny electron is itself a whole universe as complex as our own universe. And then within that great universe, every electron in it is another great universe. Perhaps our whole universe is just a tiny electron of another one that's much bigger. Well, these things are scattered here and there throughout his book Cosmos, but they make your head swim. They make you realize, if you stop to think, that he has no answer for anything, actually, just a lot of detail that is wonderful, and we've been able to learn these things, but it is tiny in proportion to all that God knows. Our knowledge is infinitesimal compared to God's knowledge. Sagan's philosophy is that everything is purely accidental. He describes the marvelous intricacy of the universe and then imagines that it is made just by accident and entirely by accident. This is purely utter nonsense. But you don't get that impression unless you read it carefully. You could easily imagine most readers of it will get the impression, my, what wonders man has accomplished. There's no end to it. He says, actually, if man doesn't destroy himself in the next few centuries with atomic warfare or pollution, we may be having communication with other people, with other intelligent beings, way off millions, billions, trillions of miles away. We may be having communication with them. How wonderful. But what will we say? What will it amount to? What understanding will it give you of what life is all about here? And so we go back to the quote in Jeremiah, quote, "My people have exchanged their glory for that which is worthless," end quote. As it has application for our own day, the word idol would seem to be out of place. But as it has application to the context and what he is immediately talking about, the word idol exactly fits in his time and perhaps some kind of rudimentary force or universal force for idol would fit in our time. And so we come face to face with the real problem of translation here. Any translation is to some extent an interpretation. And then we see in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 12, the Lord says, quote, "Be appalled at this, O heavens, and shudder with great horror. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water," end quote. Now, there's a tremendous verse exactly describing America today, exactly describing our Western world today. In fact, describing most of the thinking of the world, most of the moving world, those who are really doing things, they have largely forsaken God and dug their own cisterns, and their cisterns can't hold water. whether they be humanistic, egoistical ideas of our Western world, or whether they be the communist ideas that are strong in the Eastern world and that have a great fascination for so many people here in the West. In both cases, they are broken cisterns that cannot hold water. And the Lord continues with his rebuke of their sin. The second section I'm going to consider from chapter 2, verse 1 to chapter 3, verse 5, under the heading, quote, Judah's sin against God, end quote. Now, as you go through these sections and you see this tremendous denunciation, as you see the way he speaks about these people, I don't know how many people stop to realize how unique it is, what a tremendous thing it is that this book, that this Bible should have been kept by the Jews, that it should have been preserved by them, that it should be considered by them as their holy scripture. Frederick the Great was an atheistic, cynical military leader of Prussia 200 years ago, yet his people were largely Christians. Christianity was being taught all throughout his kingdom. He had his court chaplain, and he turned to the chaplain one time and he said, "Give me a word or something that proves Christianity." And the chaplain said, quote, "The Jews," end quote. And the continuance of the Jews when all the other nations have disappeared is a sign of God's work in the people of Israel. The continuance of Egypt today is not the same people as ancient Egypt, not the same language, not the same customs. It's entirely different. And that is true of those that preserve the names of Egyptian times and those that don't preserve the names. But the Jews have continued as a distinct group, even though they have been scattered throughout all the world, just as the Bible said they would be. But I don't think that many people who realize even the uniqueness of the preservation of the Jews as a group, I don't think that many people, even those who realize this fact, realize the most amazing fact that they have kept as their sacred writing, which they treasure and which they look to with such reverence, the book we call the Old Testament. You take the great writings that are treasured by any other nation that I've ever heard of, and they'll tell you how great their founders were and how great their nation was previously and what tremendous things they did, and they have everything good to say about them. Occasionally, they may say that their early forefathers made a mistake. But to preserve and to honor writings that denounce their people, that accuse them of all kinds of sin, that accuse them of forsaking their God, and use strong terms and criticism with the attack that we find in so many of the Old Testament, and that we find greatly in Isaiah and still more in Jeremiah, for a nation to take writings like that and preserve them and treasure them and honor them through the ages, that is absolutely unique. And we can be sure that it is no Jewish chauvinism or pride in their nation that led them to preserve these books and consider them as holy books that they should follow. It's because God marvelously led the people to treasure the writings of Jeremiah and not the writings of his opponents, the false prophets, of whom you will find there were many at that time. And the writings of others who simply glorified the nation, they did not preserve those writings either. But they did preserve writings that no nation from a purely human perspective would ever think of preserving, honoring, and glorifying. But these were the writings of God given to these people whom he had called out for his purpose, and they preserved them and they treasured them. And so we find these great rebukes as Jeremiah continues, quote, "Why do you go to Egypt and go to Assyria?" End quote. This is Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 18. In other words, you're looking for help from all sorts of clever ideas. For example, we think if we're going to get plenty of oil, we've got to give Arabs all the technology and means of defending themselves that we can, even if they have an almost absolute dictator in the world who may take over by some revolutionary force the next year, just like the Iranians were 3 or 4 years ago. Who knows what it's going to be, but we think that by trying to please them, we are going to win safety for ourselves and get plenty of oil for ourselves. And so, going back to what it says in Jeremiah, the Lord says, in an answer to that sort of thing, in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 18, quote, "Why go to Egypt to drink water from the Shihor? Why go to Assyria to drink water from the Euphrates? Your wickedness will punish you, your backsliding will rebuke you. Consider and realize how evil and bitter it is for you when you forsake the Lord your God and have no awe of me," end quote. Now the second section, which runs through Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 5, discusses Judah's sin against God. Well, we'll turn to the northern kingdom next, where we speak of both kingdoms, but we will have to look for that in the next lecture. This completes lecture number 4 on Jeremiah by Alan A. McCrae.